Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the challenge to President Obama on his doorstep, and that is the continuing protests organized by Bill McKibben at the White House to dissuade the president from allowing a pipeline from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to cross the United States, ending up at refineries in Texas. American environmentalist and writer Bill McKibben joins us. While Bill and 69 others spent last weekend in jail, the protests are continuing this week to prevent what NASA chief scientist Jim Hansen calls game over for the environment if this pipeline is built. Then a Libyan diplomat and former translator for Gaddafi, Abubakar Saad, joins us to discuss where the dictator on the run might be heading. Will Gaddafi finally hold up for a last stand in his hometown of Sirte? Will he head south to friendly tribes and then on to Zimbabwe or Venezuela? Or will he evade capture like Saddam Hussein and hide out in the maze of tunnels under Tripoli? And then finally, we'll be joined by Dr. Stephen Zunis, who I spoke with earlier at the time of the NATO intervention in the Libyan civil war. He was very critical of that intervention. We'll visit the situation now that Gaddafi appears to have been toppled, and also examine why elements of the European and the American left do not support these working class revolutions in Syria and in Libya. Joining us now is Bill McKibben, who is an American environmentalist and writer. In 2010, the Boston Globe called Bill McKibben probably the nation's leading environmentalist, and Time magazine described him as the world's best green journalist. In 2009, he led the organization 350.org, which coordinated what Foreign Policy magazine called the largest ever global coordinated rally of any kind, with 5,200 simultaneous demonstrations in 181 countries. His books include The End of Nature, The Age of Missing Information, Hope, Human and Wild, and Deep Ecology, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. On August the 20th, Bill McKibben and 69 others were arrested in front of the White House for protesting the planned pipeline that would carry oil from the tar sands of Alberta to refineries in Texas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill McKibben.
Hey, it's so good to be with you.
And now that you're no longer on a bread and water diet, although I believe the Park Service kept you longer instead of paying the $100 fine for being arrested in front of the White House, they kept you over the weekend?
Here's the deal. We were the first day of what's going to be a 14-day civil disobedience protest, the largest civil disobedience action in the American environmental movement in decades. At the moment, we're up to about almost 300 people who've been arrested over the first 4 days. But our group, the Park Service police, decided they might be able to discourage the entire protest by treating us pretty harshly, as they explained to our legal team. And so we were taken away and spent the weekend in what's called Central Cell Block in Washington, D.C. And it's exactly as much fun as it sounds like it would be. We were on stainless steel slabs without bedding, 2 to a 4 by 7 cage, and it was 100 degrees or so it seemed like, and we spent much of the time in leg irons and that kind of thing. But it didn't discourage us, and it didn't discourage anyone else. The next day, Sunday, there were another 60 or 70 people arrested, and the police were beginning to figure out that this was an expensive strategy for them. So since then, they've just been taking people and booking them and fining them and releasing them, which seems appropriate for the crime of protesting in front of the White House. At any rate, it's been a remarkable few days as we see this civil disobedience spread, and the result is that our target, this pipeline from the tar sands of northern Alberta down to Texas, has become for the first time a really national issue. While we were in jail, the New York Times published a very strongly worded editorial telling President Obama in no uncertain terms to veto this thing. Today, the leaders of all the nation's big environmental groups, for one of the first times in history, put out a strongly worded statement on which they all agreed, from the pretty corporate people like the Environmental Defense Fund to Greenpeace and Rainforest Action Network. And they all said as one that this is the premier environmental challenge for the president between now and the next election, and they expect nothing less than him to deny the permit for this so-called Keystone Pipeline.
You were quoted, of course, from jail, Bill McKibben, saying we don't need sympathy, we need company. Since you've organized this protest, that's going to go on for how long?
It'll last through September 3rd, and then it switches venues to Canada, and they'll be doing similar civil disobedience up there.
Again, I'm speaking with environmental activist Bill McKibben, who was arrested on August the 20th over the weekend for protesting the tar sands pipeline from Alberta to Texas, which of course traverses the entire United States. And I take it this is a broad coalition of not just environmentalists, but ranchers and others who don't want to see this scar across the land.
That's right. It starts with indigenous leaders in Canada and the U.S. who have been leading this opposition for a long time, because much of this oil comes from their land and much of the pipe will cross their land. Also from farmers and ranchers. We had a convoy of Nebraska ranchers who were here yesterday getting arrested. Tomorrow a bunch of people arrive from Texas who've been traveling across the country. It's very exciting. So that's, you know, the first problem with this pipeline. It'll clearly set up the possibility for a kind of terrestrial version of the BP spill we saw in the Gulf last year. We don't want that. We don't want the Ogallala Aquifer or the Yellowstone River or anybody's prime farmland to be inundated with tons of oil. The second problem, even deeper, of course, is that if that oil safely reaches the Gulf and gets refined and burned, then it not just adds to our global warming problem, it may overwhelm it. This is the second biggest pool of carbon on the planet up there in northern Alberta. Jim Hansen at NASA, our foremost climate scientist, said recently that if we start burning this tar sands oil in large quantities, it's, and here I quote, essentially game over for the climate. So this is a real test of Barack Obama because, and here's the interesting point, Ian, he doesn't have to ask Congress about this. This is his call. He has to grant or not grant what's called a certificate of national interest to get this thing built. And if he denies it, then Jim Inhofe and all the other nutballs in Congress can't do a thing to stop him. And so it's a real, opportunity to be out in front of the White House less protesting the president than telling him there's deep support for doing the right thing. When we were in jail, a number of people were saying, you know, the last time that I was sleeping on a floor, I was in some church basement getting ready to go knock on doors for Barack Obama. I really want to be reminded of why I was so excited about his election.
Again, I'm speaking with Bill McKibben, who was arrested on August the 20th for protesting the tar sands pipeline. And there does seem, you mentioned the BP spill, more and more, unfortunately, Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, about crisis capitalism seems to be coming back into play here. Because, in effect, the BP spill should have been a wake-up call for our dependence on oil and how dangerous it is to extract it and how desperate we're becoming looking for more and more places like the Alberta tar sands. And yet, instead of learning the lesson, we're told that our needs are even more desperate. It's had the reverse effect in a curious kind of way.
Well, perhaps. I mean, funny you should mention Naomi. She's been an absolute stalwart on this right from the beginning. She helped write the letter that's been drawing everybody here, and she'll be down in Washington at the end of next week for the conclusion of this whole thing. And I can't wait to see her because, as you say, she's the best analyst we've got of what's going on. And as she keeps pointing out, the only way to fight back is with just the kind of thing that we're doing.
Absolutely.
We're not going to win the battle by trying to kind of out-corporatize the other side.
And speaking of the corporate side, have you noticed ExxonMobil's advertising campaign using a very sort of friendly African-American face talking about how we desperately need this oil from the tar sands and it's so environmentally friendly?
Look, Exxon and everybody else are going to have as much money as it's possible to imagine. They've made $38 billion in the last year, more money than any company in the history of money. As long as the thing is decided in terms of money and how much you can lobby and how many TV ads you can buy, then they're going to win. We don't have that kind of money, so we better find a different currency to work in. And for these 2 weeks, our currency is our bodies, and it's having at least some effect on this debate.
And the tar sands themselves, though, I mean, the statistics are just mind-numbing, what is involved in extracting this oil and the environmental cost that we pay for it. That's the part of it that I find so absolutely mind-numbing. But Daniel Botkin of the Financial Times Press reports that mining the 2 trillion barrels from U.S. oil shale here in the United States would leave behind 9 trillion tons of waste rock. But if the tar sands are even worse, in the sense that the amount of water that's used is beyond belief.
The world's largest dam is not the Aswan Dam or the Hoover Dam or something. It's a dam around one of these tailing ponds where they have to put all the water from this, from the process of getting this oil out of the tar sands. It's Mordor up there already. And if we keep doing this thing, it's going to be, disgusting doesn't begin to describe it. Look, this is just one of these inflection points. We got to decide whether we want to be addicted to oil or not. And if we do want to be addicted to oil, then we're going to have to do this. And if we don't want to be, then it's time to cut this pipeline before we get a new supply coming in and get down to the work, the job-creating, sane work of building the next energy economy. It's going to take way more people to put up the solar panels and the windmills than it is to build the pipeline. And if Barack Obama is serious about that future, then this is where we'll go.
Just to give our audience a full perspective on the ecological horror and the scientific absurdity of extracting oil from tar sands, this is this heavy sort of viscous bitumen-like substance. And what they do is that they heat up, they pour high-pressure hot water through it to make it flow. But the point is, once the water contacts this oily black goo, that water has to be stored in the biggest pond in the entire planet, and it's completely polluted water. And one of the things that I find ironic is that we're going to find ourselves probably in a few years' time where water may be more valuable than oil.
Look, you couldn't design a dumber environmental thing than this. You got to pump in all this natural gas to heat up the oil enough to make it flow. You got to use all the water, as you described. And in the end, you then produce oil, which you burn and send yet more carbon into the atmosphere. It's craziness, but that's the craziness that goes with addiction. You know, it's no crazier than all the things addicts do for other things that they're addicted to. So it's fundamentally about whether or not we're ready to face that point yet. And we're going to keep using oil from Saudi Arabia for a while, but we got to be trying to get off of it. Saudi Arabia is already plumbed. It's not going to get shut down. This isn't plumbed yet. There's a few small pipelines coming out, but this is the first really big hose they're going to stick in this thing. And if we can block it, then as the energy minister of Alberta said recently, we're going to be landlocked in bitumen. Let's hope so.
Well, what can the public do? You're putting your body on the line, and every day people are being arrested to get the attention of the president, and it's his choice alone whether or not this thing goes ahead. What can our audience do, Bill?
So, first of all, if you can get out to Washington before September 3rd, you can come put your body on the line, too. TarSandsAction.org is the place to sign up. And people are coming from all 50 states. I had several Californians in my cell block. The guy next door was from Thousand Oaks, a water polo coach. So we'd love to have you out here. It's pretty exciting and fun and solemn and proud.
And very, very necessary, because this sounds like possibly one of the most counterintuitive steps that we could take to make this hideous product available when the cost of extracting it is even worse than all of the processes that we've got so far, including this fracking business. I mean, it's all poor Mother Nature is under assault.
The analogy that comes to mind to me is almost less to do with energy than I keep thinking about the Brazilians. Okay, they have a really important piece of biology down there, the Amazon rainforest, and the rest of the planet seems basically to have charged them with keeping it intact. That's your job, and the Brazilians are actually rising to it. They've cut their carbon emissions more than any country on Earth because they've radically slowed deforestation. Canada has a unique piece not of biology, but of geology. these tar sands. If we expect the Brazilians to guard their rainforest, why do we not expect Canadians, and by extension the Americans, to guard this giant pool of carbon in the north? Why do we just assume that they have the right to go and burn it up and send it into the atmosphere and wreck the climate? I think that that's a fundamental question, especially considering that North Americans are rich by and large and Brazilians are poor. I think it's really time to think about this more clearly than we do and to stop just making the assumption that we're going to keep doing the same thing that we did yesterday and the day before.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Bill McKibben.
My pleasure, as always. Many thanks.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Bill McKibben, who is an American environmentalist and writer. In 2010, the Boston Globe called Bill McKibben probably the nation's leading environmentalist, and Time magazine described him as the world's best green journalist. In 2009, he led the organization 350.org, which coordinated what Foreign Policy magazine called the largest ever global coordinated rally of any kind, with 5,200 simultaneous demonstrations in 181 countries. His books include The End of Nature, The Age of Missing Information, Hope, Human and Wild, and Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. On August the 20th, Bill McKibben and 69 others were arrested in front of the White House for protesting the planned pipeline that would carry oil from the tar sands of Alberta to refineries in Texas. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about where Gaddafi might be heading. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm joined now by Aboubakar Saad, who was originally from Benghazi, Libya. He's a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University and worked for the Libyan government prior to Muammar Gaddafi's coup. He stayed a government employee, eventually working for several years as Gaddafi's translator. In the 1970s, he and others plotted to overthrow Gaddafi. Professor Saad fled the country when the plot fell apart. He's now a U.S. citizen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aboubakar Saad.
Thank you very much.
I guess the fellow that you used to work for is on the run, I would think, at this point. And, of course, there are some choices that he has. I'd like to explore them with you. He may head to his hometown of Sirte, where he could make a kind of Alamo last stand. He may go to the friendly tribes in the south and perhaps leave the country for Zimbabwe or Venezuela. But he also may be holed up in the tunnels underneath Tripoli and end up like Saddam Hussein.
Well, in reality, we really don't know exactly where he is, you know. Basically, I mean, my suspicion from the very beginning, really, that he wasn't in Tripoli in the last 2 weeks. My assessment of that, I came to this conclusion because during the past few months, he was coming onto the streets, and then he disappeared from the streets, and he starts sending these telephone messages to the Libyan television. But the sound and the quality of the audio was clear and good. In the last couple of weeks, the quality of the audio began to deteriorate tremendously. And that's where I began to assess the situation as he had already left Tripoli. He's either in Sabha, down in the southwest, where Gaddafi tribes are, or in his hometown, Sirte, which is another stronghold for the Gaddafi tribes. He was not in Tripoli. But, of course, I could be wrong, because nobody really knows exactly where this man is. I remember even my days when I was working with him, and he was young and very vigorous, in power, and he was in control with everything around him. And he never slept in the same place two nights in a row. He never slept at the same hour two nights in a row. So he was already a paranoid, and he designed the whole life around him according to his paranoia.
Well, now he really has reason to be paranoid, I would think.
Exactly. Now he has more reasons to be paranoid, particularly now with the NTC is putting a price on him to be captured. And that price is actually twofold. What has been reported by the international media was that they put $1.7 million, a bounty, on him. But I heard that there is a more important bounty, which is basically directed to the people around Gaddafi. They offer them a full amnesty if they can kill or capture Gaddafi.
Well, Abu Bakr Saad, again, former Libyan diplomat and translator for Gaddafi. That's not to say, though, that Gaddafi and his sons aren't clever at manipulating the media. For example, the son who was announced that he was captured, Saif al-Islam, he apparently orchestrated that whole ruse and somehow got the international press to believe that he had been captured. He got his aides to say that he'd been handed over to the rebels. And then he shows up in front of the Western press at the hotel in the area that they still control, the loyalists, and gave this surreal press conference about, you know, hey, let's come out and go to the nightclubs and have a great time and in the hot neighborhood. Pretty crazy stuff. But it just gives you an example that these people are pretty, they've been holding on to power, not just through brutality, but through the manipulation of the press.
Exactly. Ian, you can actually just look around you in the world. How many leaders had lasted for 42 years? I mean, this man came to power when America had Nixon, you know, and just count how many presidents from Nixon on we had so far. And this doesn't come with just brutality. This is cunning, deceiving, divide and rule. I mean, he is, you know, he's a very, very, very smart guy. He comes across as he's crazy or whatever, just delusional. But he's a very smart guy. And he has some loyal people who are working for him. You know, we shouldn't really forget that there are some people in Libya who had benefited from his regime, and they are willing to help him out to the last minute.
Well, also, I believe that the vast south of the country is essentially loyal to him, even though 90% of the people in Libya live in the coastal cities. The territory is huge. So there's a lot of places in the south that he's got a lot of room to maneuver, right?
He's got mainly, really, what you can pin down. He's got only those two spots left now. Because he can't come out in Tripoli anymore. You know, even though his loyalists are still fighting in Tripoli and so forth, but really they are doomed. At the end, you know, they can fight for 2, 3, 4, 5 days, but they're gonna collapse after all. But the area that's really strongly for him and supporting him are those two spots where his tribal groups are, either Sabha in the southwest of Libya or Sirte in the central part of Libya on the coast.
So what do you think is the likely scenario then? I guess there's not much point in going over conjecture here, but a lot of the press are saying, you know, will he fight to the bitter end or will he chicken out and go into exile in Venezuela or somewhere like that? He has been defiant, saying he'll never surrender. Since you've known the guy, what's your guess on that?
Well, the mindset I knew, which lasted for 42 years, I don't think he ever changed, is that he will not surrender. He is not going to exit Libya. He is going to fight. But how long he's going to fight, that's another question. But he is not going to surrender. I doubt it very much if anybody can convince him to leave Libya.
What about his sons, though? I mean, Saif has been grown up as a playboy, for God's sake.
Yes, his sons might bite that carrot. His sons might bite that carrot, but I don't think he will ever do it.
But won't they face the ICC? Won't Saif al-Islam face the International Criminal Court? I mean, what would the carrot be that he would bite?
No, you have to remember Gaddafi has so many sons. I mean, I'm not talking about Saif. Now, he and Saif are doomed. And Abdullah Sanusi, the chief of the security, who's also at the same time Gaddafi's brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Abdullah Sanusi is Gaddafi's brother-in-law. So those three, I doubt if they will ever attempt to leave Libya, because they know that they're gonna, if they leave Libya, they're gonna be captured somewhere and they're gonna be brought back to the ICC. But the other sons, you have to remember, Gaddafi has five more sons and a daughter still around.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the ones who might escape, and they might go to another country or something like that.
Because
there's no warranty against them internationally. But in Libya, all of them, the whole Gaddafi family, he and his sons and his family, are going, if any of them is captured, is going to be put on trial in Libya.
So again, I'm speaking with Aboubakar Saad, who's a former Libyan diplomat. He was a translator for Gaddafi until he and others plotted a coup to overthrow Gaddafi, and he had to flee the country when the plot fell apart. And he's now a U.S. citizen. We're talking about the last days of the dictator, even though he may make a stand and fight in his hometown or amongst his tribe. And of course, there is the possibility of the kind of Saddam Hussein scenario, isn't there, of him just being on the run for in Saddam's case, what, for 5 months?
More than that. He was on the run from March 2003 till December 2003.
Right. So, yeah. But that's one way of maintaining a mystique, isn't it? If you haven't been captured, you know.
Yeah,
is that possible? What do you think?
Libya is not really Iraq. I mean, it would be a mistake to create that particular comparison. Libya is more tribal, and I have heard some rumors now that actually the NTC and the NATO allies and all of them are actually trying to negotiate with his tribe to surrender. So they wanted his tribe to drop their arms and so forth. And those people, if they were offered positions and money and things like that, they might not hold for too long. I mean, there are several fronts really trying to isolate and capture Gaddafi, not only just offering the bounty on his head, both money and amnesty, but also they are trying to approach the tribal groups who were loyal to Gaddafi in the past to join, who are still sitting on the fence, as we would say here in America, to join the revolution. And they were offering offering most of them amnesty and participation in the new and future Libya.
Well, I suppose that sort of makes sense, doesn't it? Because the the tribe presumably would feel that it would be punished.
Exactly.
And if you
and actually, really, the strong message that's coming from the NTC for the past few months is everybody would be included, even those who worked for Gaddafi. We wanted a peaceful, democratic Libya. We have to have the rule of the law, not the revenge. So these messages have been really relayed almost on a daily basis throughout Libya.
So Aboubakar Saad, given that you've had you work for the government, the original government before Gaddafi's coup, what's your sense of what the Libyan people want? Because there have been already warnings, if you will, to NATO and the West, saying don't impose your will in any way and try and leverage anything out of this, because The Libyan people have bitter memories of colonialism, and that's, after all, what Gaddafi, that's how he gained his traction until he betrayed Libyan liberation. So what's your reading on the likelihood of the makeup of a new government and whether or not there'll be any possibility that people could say, well, you know, NATO helped this government go into power, and it's really not, it doesn't really represent the Libyan people, it represents the Western interests?
No, really, that's not the label of the NTC of the NTC in Libya. Because you have to remember, the NTC from the day one, and actually even even before the NTC was formulated, the Libyans asked the NATO, they asked the United States, they asked all of the war powers, do not bring any soldiers on the ground. We wanted to do this job ourselves. And that's precisely to prevent that particular sinking that foreign powers came and helped this particular group to take power in Libya. So really, even, you know, I mean, if you remember the statement by President Obama, the matches was to him was very clear, and he made it very clear to everyone, no boots on the ground, if I can recall his sentence. That's basically what it was from the very beginning. So here, the Libyans, as you mentioned, are very aware of their history, are very aware of colonialism, are very aware of foreign powers. And that's why they needed the help, but let us do it our way. And that's precisely what they did so far.
So you don't fear the power vacuum then, as all the analysts say, well, Gaddafi destroyed civil society, he destroyed the military, and unlike next door in Egypt, where the military is the main kind of glue at the moment, he built East Praetorian Guard, destroyed the military, destroyed all the government operations and civil society. Yeah. For this kind of rule of the strong man and personality cult, etc.
Libya and Egypt are completely different. In Egypt, we didn't have the civil war and the destruction and the killing and thousands of lives lost. But you have to remember, we can't really call Libya has a political vacuum anymore. Because the NTC is really moving quickly, and let me give you an example of the NTC. Almost every member of the NTC is a college graduate. Some of them have master's degrees and PhDs. Many of them are well-trained professionals. And to give an example, one of them, the head of the government, Mahmoud Jibril, has a doctorate degree from the University of Pittsburgh here in the United States, and many others from London, from Paris, from Rome, from everywhere. These are professionals, and they have waited so long for this opportunity. The Libyan people had waited so long for this opportunity. My feeling, although I am far away here, my feeling, they are not going to budget. Of course, they are going to have some squabbles. Put a pot of money in front of five people and they're going to fight over it, you know. But in reality, that they are well prepared. They actually thought of that mission. The problem is, as you just mentioned, there were no institutions in the country. Gaddafi destroyed every institution. None of the cities doesn't even have a mayor or a city council or any stuff like that. So here, these people are going to build from scratch, but they are going to build from scratch with good education, with good expertise that's coming to them from all over the world. Everybody is volunteering to help them out. The United States is volunteering to help them out. Britain is volunteering to help them out. France is volunteering. The United Arab Emirates, Qatar, everybody is really waiting for them to clean up Gaddafi, and everybody is ready to actually help them out right away. So they are actually more fortunate than the Iraqis, because the case of Iraq is completely different. Who removed Saddam in Iraq? It was the Americans. It wasn't the Iraqis. Here, the Libyans are the ones who are removing Gaddafi. So it's a completely different picture. Even when people come and help them afterwards, they are not going to have the label that they are agents of a foreign power.
Well, then, just in closing, then, Abu Bakr Saad, two questions. One,
sure.
It sounds like you don't fear retributions and vengeance, and there are reports of some looting. So,
it is going to happen. No, there's going to be because you have to remember, this is a vast country. This is the second largest country on the continent of Africa. So they are not going to control everything overnight. There are going to be pockets, and there are going to be people who are going to be revenge. I mean, if you belong to a family and three or four members of your family had been killed by Gaddafi, I expect you to take revenge. So, no, there are going to be cases, but it is not going to be the whole population revenge, those who were against Gaddafi and those who were up for Gaddafi just to be slaughtered and so forth. No, it is going to be individual cases or a very, minor cases here and there. You can't really prevent that.
And just in closing, when do you think the oil will be pumping again and shipping again? And will that go to a new kind of treasury that won't go straight into the – obviously, it's not going to go straight into Gaddafi's pocket as the way it used to.
Yeah, no, it is not. And that's one of the things. See, that is one of the things that the NTC is advocating. Everybody would be included. That means included not only in politics, in the benefits, in the projects, in the employment, in everything. They are advocating inclusion of every Libyan in the country, and that's really a good message in that sense. For your part of the question that when the oil will get flowing again, it depends on how much damage to these installations have been done during the fighting over it. The reports I have received so far that the Zawiya refinery, the last one they took outside of Tripoli, is the least damaged. So I anticipate that would be functioning within a few weeks or at least a couple of months. The Brega, I have heard there's an extensive damage that might take more than a few months to actually get it going.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's
always good to talk to you and get an update on where things are. And again, thank you, Abu Bakr Saad.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Abu Bakr Saad, who is originally from Benghazi, Libya. He's a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University and worked for the Libyan government prior to Muammar Gaddafi's coup. He stayed a government employee, eventually working for several years as Gaddafi's translator. In the 1970s, he and others plotted to overthrow Gaddafi. Professor Saad fled the country when the plot fell apart. He is now a U.S. citizen. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the toppling of Gaddafi will affect the North African neighborhood.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Hello.
Hi, Stephen. It's Ian Masters here. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. So we can get rolling, I think. If you could just tell me how the weather is. You're in San Francisco?
Foggy.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. How's that sound? Okay, we're good to go. All right. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Stephen Zunis, who is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle East Studies. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy and Focus Project of the Institute for Policy Studies, an associate editor of Peace Review, a contributing editor to Kuhn, and chair of the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Zunis.
Good to be back.
And we spoke last time at the time of the NATO intervention in the Libyan civil war, and you were on the side of the skeptics about the very nature of the intervention in terms of NATO, and felt that, in fact, had it stayed a nonviolent conflict, the Libyan people would have been better off. What's your take on it now, given that the Libyan people seem to be celebrating a victory?
You know, it's always hard to project, in hindsight, various alternative scenarios. I mean, the bottom line is that it's great that they are freed of Gaddafi. And I also just want to appreciate you for not just, falling into kind of the more knee-jerk, hard-left, conspiratorial view behind the criticisms of the intervention. At the same time, I remain a little nervous. History has shown that dictators overthrown by armed struggles, particularly if they involve heavy foreign intervention, are far more likely than overthrows of dictators by largely nonviolent means to either fall into factional fighting or slide into another dictatorship. There's something about the martial values and military hierarchy that's inherent in armed struggle that tends to carry over to the new regime. One thing gives me a little bit of hope, though, is that this final push, though obviously NATO did play a significant role, did involve a large-scale civil insurrection within Tripoli itself. It wasn't just these forces from the east or marching into the city. In fact, the reason the regime collapsed so quickly was that they were faced with a working-class neighborhoods within Tripoli itself in open rebellion to the regime, which gives the Tripolitanians some ownership of the revolution, and hopefully will be a harbinger for a more pluralistic future.
But Stephen Zunis, that's not to say that there was valid criticism at the time that we last spoke. Indeed, I spoke to Edward Luttwak, who's quite conservative, and his objection to the liberal interventionists, and this was at the time when Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice and Samantha Powell were apparently all weighing in on the president. And the right-wing critique from Edward Luttwak was that there's no consistency in this, in the humanitarian intervention, because, after all, there's been an ongoing Holocaust in the Congo, for example. Mm-hmm. So that leads you to just tee off from what Luttwak was saying. We're not intervening in the Congo to stop wholesale slaughter of people. Why? Well, I'd hazard a guess that it may have something to do with oil, right?
Yeah, that was certainly one factor. Also, the fact that Gaddafi was pretty vulnerable. I mean, whereas the Congo is a series of different factions going after each other, marauding bands, et cetera, we had a one-man rule, a man who had alienated pretty much everybody, left, right, center, nationalist, Islamist, pretty much everybody by his capricious and arbitrary rule. So I think the folks at NATO really thought it would be a pretty quick and easy kind of a low-risk proposition. Of course, it ended up being anything but. It was long, it was protracted, there was a lot of damage, and undoubtedly there'll still be some bitterness and divisions within Libyan society that it's going to take a while to rebuild and put together. But I think it was ultimately victorious, again, because the people of Libya wanted him out. And I think the military historians and others will argue about, how much was the NATO destruction of the command and control structure and the ability to fly aircraft and whatever, how decisive was that, versus the fact that this did lead to something of a nationalist reaction. The Libyans are among the more xenophobic people in the Arab world, and it may have in many ways solidified his support stronger and for a longer time. So it remains a debate. to Obama's credit, this is not a unilateral American thing brought in. You know, in fact, it was not even led by the United States. There was some sort of UN mandate, though, unfortunately, I think it went well beyond that. So the mandate, which is simply to protect civilian lives, and I'm a little concerned about the precedent there. But I think it was more a sense that this is something that that intervention could work, whereas many of these other scenarios, it would have been logistically more difficult. But at the same time, I think you're right. Obviously, the great resources that Libya had and strategic location, all that, it certainly played a factor as well.
Well, Dr. Stephen Zunis, it seems to me, though, that there is another explanation that hasn't really been discussed very much, and it's my theory, in the sense that I still believe that realpolitik did play a role, even though it was sold to the American people and NATO sold it to their partnership on the basis of a humanitarian intervention to stop a slaughter of civilians in Benghazi. And after all, Gaddafi had said he would do it. He said that there were insects and roaches and whatever. And he'd made it pretty clear that it would have been a bloody retribution there. I would have thought, though, that had that happened, in other words, had the intervention not taken place, and had Gaddafi gone ahead and done what he threatened to do, he would become an international pariah. He would be victorious, but he would be facing sanctions from the West, and there'd be no way that in the world that any Western government could deal with him. But that wouldn't mean that the Chinese and the Russians wouldn't jump in and make all kinds of oil deals, particularly the Chinese, who make no bones about dealing with Myanmar and Sudan and other unsavory regimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to is how does a regime have power? And obviously, military power was one way of overcoming Gaddafi, and it proved, at least eventually, to be effective. But I still believe there are some options in terms of a combination of international sanctions and of civilian resistance that may indeed have worked. Because the Chinese and Russians, they did not veto the initial UN Security Council resolution. I think they're upset that NATO went well so far beyond the mandate of the UN. But the very fact that they allowed this thing to go through, I think, was indicative that even in their view, Gaddafi had gone too far.
What do you think, though, of the general, how this intervention and particularly the critiques on the left are sitting with, in other words, I often ask myself why the left is so small in this country and doesn't reach out to the center and doesn't have much traction. And I'm wondering now whether the fact that there's still voices on the left defending Gaddafi, if you consider Hugo Chavez and people like that credible sources, this to me is really could be a time where a lot of people on the left are being totally discredited.
Certainly, I think in many ways is indicative of just how U.S. policy in the region has so shattered U.S. credibility. The very fact that the United States has supported and Israel and its killings of 700-800 civilians in Gaza Strip in early 2009 and just a couple years before that, a similar number in Lebanon. And he had this overwhelming bipartisan majority of Congress claiming it was legitimate self-defense. And then, of course, the atrocities and lies around Iraq. I mean, there's a degree of skepticism that's gone beyond healthy skepticism, but the one to cynicism that rules out even the possibility of the right to protect humanitarian intervention. And fortunately, I think what comes out of Libya is a mixed bag. I mean, a lot of it will depend on what happens in the coming weeks or months, whether there will be a stable democratic transition. But I think there's also the fact that it did take as long as it did, that the number of overall people killed in the war may arguably have surpassed what might have transpired if Gaddafi had gone ahead and reconquered Benghazi. I think this is still going to be debated, and I think there's some good arguments to be made by each side. I would just encourage listeners to maintain a healthy skepticism, but at the same time, not fall into this kind of simplistic critique, especially on the oil situation. I mean, Gaddafi had great deals with these Western oil companies, Total, NEI, BP. I mean, they were making lots of money off of Libya. He was real happy to deal with him. The Western nations did not need to overthrow him simply to have access to the oil, because they had access to the oil already. It's far more a complex situation. I think either the knee-jerk defenders or the knee-jerk supporters of the NATO military action would like to make it sound.
The one thing, though, that bothers me about the left in the sense that it may be opening itself up to be discredited. And I'd like to get your insight into this, because it troubles me that many of these revolutions that are happening now with the Arab Spring are working class revolutions. Look at Syria, for example. The revolt against the Assad started in the poorest town, Diriyah, and all the suburbs of Damascus, where the resentment and the resistance is, and the support for the revolution is, are the working class neighborhoods. And it's true in Libya, as you just mentioned. It's the eastern part of Libya that's all the working class that welcomed the rebels, and they're able to move in so quickly.
And the working class neighborhoods in Tripoli were the center of the final uprising.
That's last week. Exactly.
It's interesting. I mean, it's ironic because, you know, Libya and Syria do engage in kind of socialist rhetoric, but in fact, these are the regimes that had pretty much bought off the middle class and more elite elements, and the rebellion in both countries have been centered very much among the poor and working class.
Against the elite,
and the
people in Tripoli that support Gaddafi still are the trickle down cronies, and the same with the Assad cronies. So again, it makes you wonder. Here we are in this country where we can have a vigorous leftist critique against the Koch brothers, but why would anybody support these Assads and Gaddafis who are even worse?
Oh no, they're very much so. I mean, I think there's many people on the American left have sort of adopted the very saying that is common in the Arab world: the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and that but of course, anti Western imperialist does not necessarily mean left. It can be these repressive, bureaucratic, personalist regimes that unfortunately end up causing a reaction. I mean, I think if Libya does move into a more neoliberal direction, the post-Gaddafi era, I think it will be not as much a result of NATO intervention as it is, as we saw in Eastern Europe. People, there'll be a tendency for people just to want to flip to the other direction. If what they experience is supposedly socialism, they want anything but. But that remains to be seen. I mean, I'm in many ways I'm less though I am skeptical in many aspects of the NATO intervention. What I'm more concerned about, in fact, is what NATO is going to do in the post Gaddafi era. How much the United States and Western European countries are going to try to shape the post-Gaddafi order, and I'm concerned that many of the brave Libyans who risk all to overthrow this tyrant are going to be pushed aside by certain new elites that Western powers will cultivate. I mean, I think this is the this is what I think the left needs to have some thoughtful critiques about.
And it's certainly something that would be so counterproductive and so counterintuitive on the part of the West, because this Libya has the fiercest anti-colonial political DNA of, I think, of most countries in the Middle East and North Africa.
Yeah, I mean, the Italian colonial conquest was among the most brutal in Africa or the Middle East. And and that's one of the reasons I was actually skeptical around the intervention, because I was afraid that Gaddafi would use that to justify to get people to rally around the flag, and to a certain degree that he was successful. But I think the Libyans, I think we need to underscore whether or not one supported the NATO intervention, that this was indeed a popular revolution. And so I think the main task for international solidarity, if you will, would be to support efforts by the Libyan people to determine their own future, and not to allow this opening as a result of the overthrow of Gaddafi. Well, I think it's certainly a good thing to be used as an entree for undue Western influence.
So just to, in the last few minutes then, to turn Stephen Zunis again, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle East Studies. We were talking earlier about the Syrian revolution and how it's basically a working class revolution, as indeed the Libyan revolution is, in the sense that it's the poor who support, who want to overthrow these dictators, and it's the wealthy elites that want them to stay in place because of the crony capitalism trickle down that they enjoy. But when we talk about cynicism about the motives of the West in Libya, I don't think that holds a candle to the cynicism involved in and around Syria, because there's clearly ambivalence on the part of Israel, for example. They don't seem, and there's certain ambivalence on the part of the West. And frankly, Obama has been forced into these sanctions. This is not something, you know, if we were seeing pictures of the slaughter that goes on in the streets of Syria, I think the situation would be different. So I find this situation very, very cynical. And given that the Iranians are the ones that are sending in their Guards Corps to prop up the Syrian secret police and propping up the Assad's to the tune of about $7 billion at the moment, it makes you wonder about our kind of duplicity and double standards.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I in certain ways, I think, given the history of the United States in Syria, everything from when the Reagan administration were attacking Syrian armed forces in Syria, the Syria Accountability Act, which was the most one of the most ridiculous pieces of legislation passed in recent years. I mean, obviously, there was legitimate concerns about Syria's overbearing role in Lebanon, but this went way beyond that to, clearly designed to to encourage greater U.S.-Israeli hegemony in the region. I mean, our whole history with Syria is such that the opposition, unlike in Libya, has been very clear. They do not want Western intervention. They have maintained their nonviolent discipline. Because despite the incredible atrocities, the movement is still growing, and the regime is weakening. And they believe that, as I do, that eventually they will be the victorious. So I'm really hoping that whether it be government policy or the position of the left, that we trust the people of these countries to determine their own future, and that we to underscore the fact that whether it be pro-Western regimes, like Egypt and Tunisia, Yemen, Bahrain, or historically anti-Western regimes like Syria and Libya, people want freedom. People want social justice. Now, this is a universal kind of thing, and I think it is wrong for both Western governments and elements of the left who try to decide whether or not they're going to support freedom based on some cynical geopolitical calculation.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Stephen Zunis. I enjoyed the conversation.
Me too.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Zunis, who is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle East Studies. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy in Focus project of the Institute for Policy Studies. He's an associate editor of Peace Review, a contributing editor of Tikkun, and chair of the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassida. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.